irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Said softly with the hush of falling leaves, casting shivering shadows on the houses through the trees. And the light from a street lamp paints a pattern on my wall, like the pieces of a puzzle or a child's uneven scrawl.
That is Patterns from Simon & Garfunkel's Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme album. And it's such a fitting song for this evening, trust me. And hi, Richard.
Hey, Jim. That was a pretty good selection tonight. I like
Thanks.
That.
I you know, I'm trying to match our guests. And so, sometimes I don't make it. Sometimes I do.
There you go.
Okay.
You did tonight.
I did. Thanks. Hey, this is LA Talk Radio, and this is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, in studio with Richard Polinelli. And Bobby Jean just tried calling in, but she did it right at the intro, and we can't answer the phone then, Bobby. So give us a holler back in a couple minutes. And what do you got going? I mean, we've just been a great week. I just did two days of co-hosting for Sam. And hang on just a second. Let me see if I can get her on there.
Are we trying to dial her in here?
Bobby, are you here? Oh, hold on. Bobby,
hear,
are you there?
I hear Bobby.
I am. Can you?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Okay. Well, we have you can't call in that early. It's got to be before or after the intro.
I'm sorry. I had some trouble.
Oh, well, okay. I will allow trouble.
Well, there is such a thing called New Mexico time out there, so it's, you know, you say 7,
true.
And it's more like 7-ish.
That is true. So, Bobby, bear with us. We're going to get through the commercials, and we'll get right to merging the call. But then we have Peter on the other line. So we'll get them all merged, and we'll get this show started. Take it away, Richard.
Okay. Congratulations, young first-time author or old first-time author. You finally typed the words, the end, to your first book. I got some bad news for you. The hard work is just starting. You need to have it edited, formatted, and create a cover for it in preparation for it to be released. Then you'll need to market it so that readers will find and purchase your book. Now, that sounds like a lot of work, and it is. Which is why the folks at Tuscany Bay Books and Black Dog Publishing are here to help you out. We'll do all the heavy lifting for you so you can get paid for your work and get back to writing your next book, and all at a royalty rate that is second to none. To find out more about our program for first-time authors, including access to an editor and cover artist at a reduced cost, give us a call at 805-795-3165 or email us at jchristina@tuscanybaybooks.com. Or R. Polinelli at TuscanyBayBooks.com, and we'll tell you everything you need to know to become a published author.
Yes.
And get some money.
Yes. In fact, we just delivered 45 books out to Citrus College yesterday. Yesterday? No, day before.
Day before, and yeah. it was an adventure getting back off the campus.
It was an adventure getting to the campus. We actually had to find a policeman to kind of lead us to where we were going.
Yeah.
You would have laughed your butt off, Bobby, because we were like two lost children. We really, truly were. Okay. Out West is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and the Western lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. There you go. I'm Italian. I can do that. National brands include Scully Leather Company, Rockmount Ranchwear, Dan Post Boots, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. If you want to shop online, go to www.scvoutwest.com, enter the code WB100, like a lot of people have, and receive $10 off your order. Or you can call toll-free at 877-340-9378. And since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service, TFM Truckload, that's the best in the industry. Not only are they exceptionally good at what they do, but they strive to make your full truckload shipping experience unparalleled. Call TFM Truckload today, 844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski or any of the fine Target TFM staff and tell them you heard it here on the Writer's Block. TFM will have just a little something extra for you. And if you're an LTL shipper, getting your freight moved your way, the most expedient way possible, is what you need. One-stop shop, no hassle. Call Target Freight Management today. Their customized traffic movement program is the finest in the industry, bar none. So call them at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web for both truckload and LTL. Call today. No fooling. You will not be sorry you did. And I have to tell you, I got a thing from Mike the other day, and he was waiting for spring to come by so he could drive his Ferrari.
Yeah, it's hard to drive a Ferrari on icy roads.
And he was standing next to his new little personal jet. So Target Freight is doing well.
I think that's a good indication if you got a personal jet. Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you for your sponsorship, Mike. We appreciate it. Target Freight's been with us since almost inception. So we're glad to have them, and we're glad to have everybody. And let's see if we can merge these calls. Bobby Jean, are you hanging on to your? I don't even know if you're wearing a hat. Your hat?
I'm hanging on to my headphones.
Okay, let's see if we can do this. Okay, who do we have? Who do we not have? Bobby Jean, we have you.
You have Bobby Jean.
Okay, we have Bobby Jean. Resume call. Do we have Peter?
Uh-oh. No. Peter's lost in the Twilight Zone.
We do not. Resume. Let's see. Resume call. Who do we have now? Bobby Jean, still?
I'm still here.
Ah, crap. Okay, we're going to have to call Peter back. Help!
Yeah.
Well, see, when I couldn't merge it when she called in because she called in too early.
While Jim and Ronan battle the wild internet here, here's Bobby Jean to tell you about Mutual of Omaha's life insurance program. There we go.
This is like, wow.
We have chaos in the booth.
Okay, we
here.
Can do that. Okay, we can do that. Oh, Peter, you there? Peter, Mr. Guidich, are you there? Nah, anything hung up. What? Keep talking to it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, Peter, are you
Hello?
Still there?
There you are.
Hello.
Hey.
God.
I'm here now.
I have to tell you, technology just absolutely pisses me off because I have, you know, one little thing and okay, Bobby Bell. Oh,
yes.
There you go. Okay, now we have you.
So now we're going to say all hail Ronan. Thank you, sir.
I don't know. Well Ronan, done. Ronan, well our engineer is in here. He's doing something, and whatever he is, he has magic fingers, and it worked. Okay.
I think he has a voodoo doll in his back pocket. I'm just saying. That's all.
Peter Guidich, he's our guest tonight. He's from Vancouver, British Columbia. He was born and raised in Vancouver. His parents are immigrants from Hungary or Eastern Europe. Came over in the early 1950s. Myriad reasons. He had a lot of problems in his youth, and has written a book, The Inheritance of Shame. And I really don't want to go too much into his bio. I really want to get into his book a little bit. And so, Peter, welcome to the Writer's Block.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've written quite a book, and I have to tell you that as we spoke the other night on the phone, it was kind of hard to get through, and it's kind of hard to get through because of the things that went on in your lifetime. It's really hard to assimilate that and think that one person can actually go through all of that and come out the other side a rational, sound human being. So I applaud you.
Well, thank you.
Oh, sure.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
I was going to say that was your cue. You could say something now. we're going to make fun of everybody tonight, Peter, so gird your loins.
Sure.
No. Go ahead, Bobby.
It was just a remarkable book, Peter. This is Bobby, and I'll just jump in right here to say, just like Jim is saying, I found it a little challenging in the beginning, but it was so eloquently written, so engaging and so compelling that I could not put it down. And you share such a story that hits on so many levels. There is something in there for every reader, and I thank you for writing it.
Oh my God, I really appreciate that. Thanks, Bobby.
You know, it's your comment to me the other night was you read it in a week, and a lot of people take months to read this book, and I could actually could see how, because it, you know, it's a chore. It's like a job, and it's not that it's a bad book. It's just that it's you have to process so much information while you're reading it. It's very amazingly written, and it's very vivid, extremely vivid, and some of the things that you bring out, and I'm going to allow you to pretty much tell as much or as little about that as you want. The comment I want to make is when I was coming to the end of the book, and it was upon your return to the United States, it started building to the point where I all of a sudden understood why it was so important for you to finish this book. By the time you got to the end of the book, and I totally got the picture of the reuniting with your family, and especially with your father, and reading his story, I can really see that, because my grandparents immigrated from Italy, and it was always a real chore for me as well, and I never assimilated with my grandparents at all. But I applaud you, and I could see the reason why it was important for you to finish this tome. So congratulations, and you've done a wonderful job.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate that. Yeah, it was a long journey to finish the book and to get it published. Both parts of that journey were equally challenging.
I'm sure.
Writing the book and also finding a publisher for it. So I'm really happy and relieved that it's published and it's out there. So thanks.
And I would assume at this point that it is doing well, because I have not read a bad review at all.
Yeah, thank you. Well, the reviews I've received have been very good, and the reader reviews, which to me is what it's really all about, you know, reaching people, those have been, you know, really good, great. And also some people have reached out to me. And sent me, some people, the one person sent me, I had to copy and paste it into a Word document to know how long her email was. It was a 3,000-word email.
That's like a novella.
Yeah. You know, she read the book, and she was so overwhelmed by it. She wrote me, and of course, I won't go into what she said to me.
Sure.
But it was so moving to me to have this reader, I mean, a person I don't know, obviously, be impacted by the book and to write to me. So that meant a lot.
Well, I like I said, I was so amazed, as they used to say in literature.
You know, Peter, you mentioned getting it to a publisher to publish it. I'm kind of curious, how long did that process take? Because this is not a book every publisher would want to take on.
Yeah.
So how long did that take you to get an agent, if you got one, and then get it published?
Well, that's a really complicated journey and probably answer, so I'll try to be brief. But I started pitching the book way too early. In retrospect, you know, we always have a different understanding of these things, because the content of the book, what I was trying to put out there in the world, felt so urgent to me that as soon as I had a draft, I basically started pitching it. So, you know, it wasn't ready. But so in terms of finding an agent and going through that process, it started a long time ago, like in 2006. And, you know, I started it really seriously in 2004 to write it. So after about 3 years of pitching and, you know, hundreds of rejections, I got an agent, and he submitted it to, you know, I did a lot of revising with this agent in New York, and he submitted it to all the, you know, top publishing houses, Random House and Penguin and all of these. And you know, we actually got really close. You know, it's like close but far away, right, to getting a deal. And, of course, it was devastating at the time to not get it sold, but I'm so happy it didn't, because even at that point, I don't think I had lived long enough through the journey I was trying to tell in the book. And so when it didn't sell, I basically had to go back to square one and look at the book. I put it away for a while. I workshopped it at some writers' retreats, you know, writers' colonies, and kept living and living the story of the book because, you know, the surviving the conversion therapy and reconciling with my family was an ongoing, and to this day it's an ongoing journey. So that continued, and meanwhile the book kept changing because as I healed from that process, I understood my past differently. And so constantly revising not the facts of the story, you know, what happened with the psychiatrist and the medications and the actual treatment to try and change my sexuality, but in terms of my interpretation of it, or rather the meaning that I had gleaned from it, these things were changing constantly. So in about 2013, I reached out and hired a developmental editor. I needed a third person, you know, like somebody who was completely objective to read everything I had, which he did, and he told me what was missing, and you know, there wasn't a lot of work that needed to be done, but it was so much fine tuning that it really just brought it all together. And I went through that process with him, and then soon after is when I found my publisher, you know, through one of the pitches that I sent out.
And who is your publisher? I don't think I know that. Oh, Brown Paper Press.
Yeah. Brown Paper Press in Long Beach, California.
Oh, right, just down the road.
Yeah. Hop, skip, and an airplane ride.
Hey, with traffic the way it is, you need a helicopter to get from here to Long Beach.
You need a helicopter to get from Simi Valley to...
Yeah, pretty much. But
may I ask Peter a question?
Of course.
Anything.
Okay.
Just raise your hand, Bobby Jean. We can't see it.
One of the things that I found was so remarkable is the dialogue and the moment-to-moment, you know, way that you cover your life over all of the years that the memoir is covering. I can hardly remember a conversation I had with anybody, you know, 2 weeks ago, kind of word for word, and yet I felt every line was authentic and real, and it wasn't that you were trying to remember something from the past and kind of making it up. I felt like I'm right there with you in your therapy sessions and so forth. How were you able to capture all of that for us?
Thank you for asking, and that's a great question, and I've been asked that before. First of all, you know, what people sometimes forget, even though I tell them, is that I've been working on this book for 20 years. So they hear 20 years or 30 years ago the events, and they think, how could you remember 30 years ago? Well, I don't remember 30 years ago. I started working on the book 20 years ago. And moreover, when I was going through the therapy, I kept journals. And a lot of those journals were because of the doctor told us to write, you know, sessional reports about our therapy sessions. I had started my undergraduate degree in creative writing and in playwriting, and dialogue was always something I loved. And so as I went through different experiences in my journal, my personal journals, I would often just write down, you know, what had happened, what people had said, even in the therapy house, which we called the Sticks, STYX. I would write down things that people would say, and I didn't, you know, think at that time that I would ever do anything with it. I was just so struck by it. And then I had these surrogate parenting sessions, and sometimes there was dialogue there, or, you know, just conversations, and I would write them down. So, of course, years later, when I went to write the book, I had a lot of this stuff written down. And then there were tapes, you know, in the therapy sessions, we were supposed to tape record our sessions and then, you know, listen to them later and discuss them. And I had some of these tapes still. So there was one scene in particular, and I say scene because, you know, my history is, as you know, creative writing is what I was starting, and playwriting. But there was one event in the book where I was with this woman who was doing a therapy session with me as a therapist, and this was actually recorded. And so when I went to write it in the book, I literally transcribed the tape, and I had to cut out like three quarters of it because it went on for like an hour. So, you know, this is how I was able to capture all these conversations. And so to me, it was really important to not invent anything. Not that memoirs ever invent, but in terms of dialogue, mm-hmm. I didn't want to say, put things in quotes if they weren't actual things that had been said.
Yeah.
So what's in the book is what I gleaned from all of these sources.
And you spent 6 years in the sticks.
Is that 6 years? Actually, I was in the therapy 6 years, and I lived in the sticks, this therapy house. I think it was 5 years at the end of the day. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Did you ever, at any time, and I'm sure this has been asked of you, did you ever at any time while you were in the therapy house or the sticks, did you ever stop and think to yourself late at night or say, God, this is bullshit? You know, I can understand that because, you know, reading your book, I get that. I don't know what I would do. I don't know what anybody would do. I mean, it was pretty intensive, as obvious and spoken in your book, it's very intensive, and it's wow.
I didn't. You know, the answer to that is no, I didn't until yes, I did.
Ah, right? And when you said yes, you did, that was it. You were out.
Well, I mean, that was the beginning of the end,
right?
And it wasn't so much thinking, oh, this is bullshit. It was having your life sort of crumble down around you,
right,
and realize everything that you had been doing and living was a lie. And that's the beginning of the process to leave or to change, like actually change your life. And that, you know, but remember through, and I'm sure you do remember, but for readers or for listeners, I was highly medicated. I was medicated very early in the therapy, and then the medication just progressively escalated throughout. And so the medication alone and the trauma of the therapy, which was primal therapy, so all these things combined, you know, there wasn't like this clear mental process of seeing things objectively. I mean, you're just in the middle of the storm. You don't see it.
It was interesting to me that at the same time you were so concerned about the medications. You did a lot of research when you first met with the doctor and he was telling you you'll need to take these medications and only in order to continue. And you also were reading different books that were being recommended for you to, you know, learn more about the process. And I thought, you know, to me that was so interesting that you didn't just kind of take on faith, oh, this is what I need to do, but you were investigating it at the same time.
Both things were happening. Yes, I was investigating, and you know, it's one of these things. It's so hard to sort of relay. I mean, I'm 24, 25 years old. I'm nervous. I know I need help. I'm nervous about the idea of medication, but I have no other recourse. At the time, it felt like I had no other recourse in my life. Isolated from my family, alienated in a new city, and the sexual abuse, which is a predominant theme in the book, the history of sexual abuse, you know, knowing that I have to somehow face this, deal with this in therapy, and not having any other option except this man who I was referred to.
Mm-hmm.
And just, it's like jumping off a cliff. It's like, okay, I have to trust this person. And so, yes, I mean, the medication made me nervous. I learned a little bit about what primal therapy was, which made me nervous. But then it's like, okay, I'm going to trust.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And you tried, if I remember reading the book right, you tried to switch away from the psychiatrist and go to somewhere else. And I think you were told you could not do that, right?
Right early when I first met the doctor, I was so shocked by his behavior. I mean, he was volatile right from day one. You know, he refused to answer questions about his background, his education. Called me Sonny Boy. I mean, just really erratic things. And so I went back to my my family physician who'd referred me, and I said, you know, I don't feel comfortable. I want to go somewhere else. And he said, there's no one. No one else in this city is taking new patients, so you have to wait maybe 2 years. And at that point, I mean, I was suicidal. I'd come out. My family had rejected me. I just didn't know where to turn.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was other things going on. I won't get into all of it, obviously, about my sexuality.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went back to the doctor. And you know, it's funny, in quotes. It was like this common theme in the sticks about, oh, the doctor, he's crazy. You know, oh, yes, this is the way he is. He's crazy, but, oh, his therapy's great. You know, this is sort of how we talked about it at the house.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what to think. I just felt like I had no other option in my life.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I have to say that as I read further and further and further into your therapy and into your time with the doctor and in the sticks, and when you finally came to the point where you had your final, I don't know, meeting, confrontation with, you call him what, Dr. Alfonso?
Yes.
And you make another mm-hmm. appointment, and then you don't go. And then you write a letter of complaint to the board. I was wanting to get stand up and cheer for you.
Oh, I know.
I just want to say, good for you, good on you, Peter.
Exactly. Like, yay, go for it.
Yeah. You know, I just
of course,
I felt cleansed for you.
Yeah, and of course, there was 2 years between, you know, as you say, the final meeting with the doctor and when I wrote that letter.
Yeah.
2 years of just devastation. I mean, after I left the therapy, and I don't even like to use that word because to me it wasn't therapy, something that's beneficial and helpful. This was just torture, right? So after I left this, you know, relationship with this man, 2 years of shock, and I was numb and devastated. You know, when you read reports today about conversion therapy, as people call it. Of course, for every person that's in this type of treatment, it's going to look a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my story. But when you read reports, you hear about, you know, the after effects. People are depressed and sometimes suicidal, and you know, they turn to drugs or whatever. Well, this is it. I mean, I was just in shock.
Mm-hmm.
Afterward. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have those words, conversion therapy. I mean, today at least we have some language.
Mm-hmm.
People can say, oh, this is what it is. You know, it's conversion therapy. You know, I understand that from books. Back then there were no words like that. It was just I didn't know what to call it, but I couldn't understand what had happened for these 6 years, because at this point when I left, I was also reducing the medication. And so my mind was clearing. And
right.
So I could think almost my thoughts for the first time, my
right.
own thoughts. And I just couldn't wrap my head around what had happened.
It almost sounds like writing the book was better therapy was for
cathartic.
You than the therapy yeah. that you got from the quote-unquote professional therapist. You know, do you agree with that? Did you find that happening as you were writing the book?
Well, it's always a little odd to say writing is therapeutic. You know, there's so much literature out there about, oh, writing for the public shouldn't be therapy, quote unquote. But you know, it was and it wasn't. I mean, of course, writing the truth was therapeutic. You know, I was able to articulate this is, you know, find my voice. This is what happened. This is the truth. But at some point, it's not just a therapy, right? The writing isn't just therapy. It's actually work.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But it's true, of course. I mean, writing the truth, and so this was so important to me, going back to the dialogue, about writing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's tons of stuff that's just not in the book, because, well, you can't put everything in. And I only wanted to put in what I know was, you know, fact and truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well done. And again, I applaud you. Your book was phenomenal. For those of you who have been listening, the name of the book is, of course, is Inheritance of Shame. Peter Gajdic is our guest tonight. He is the author. And if you want to call and talk to Peter, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. 4929. I'm going to take a minute here to talk to you a little bit about All Dogs Rule in Fillmore, California, and we'll be back to you in just a minute, Peter and Bobby. So don't go away.
Thanks.
Okay, hold on. You're leaving on vacation. Tickets have been purchased and your hotel reservations are confirmed. Mail delivery has been suspended. And what about your dog? Well, All Dogs Rule day camp and sleepovers. It's the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside among orange trees and grass in a country setting. Your dog gets to be, well, your dog gets to be a dog. All Dogs Rule offers additional services, including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming sessions in the creek, and training. Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. When your pup returns home with a smile on his face, it will leave you wondering whose vacation was better. And the answer, of course, is Richard.
The dog.
That dog.
The
there
dog.
You go.
Yep.
And that's Russ Avison. Russ will be actually in the studio with me next week.
I would drop our dog off, but Russ would expect us to come back and get him again.
I know. Well, no, he delivers.
He does.
Oh, he does.
Ooh, even better.
And he does. Okay, well, we are back. It is now 7:30 on Thursday, January 18th of 2018. Holy crap, we've gone so far. We are on the air with Peter Gaidich, and of course Bobby Jean Bell is on the phone with us from her new home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Peter, let's talk a little bit about when you were sitting down actually and starting to write this book. How long did you sit at a time and try to suss everything out? Because that had to have been confusing and it had to have been hard for you to write at first.
Great question. Thank you. So going back, I actually started sketching the book in 1997 when I wrote the complaint letter about the doctor to the to the College of Physicians. I knew at that point that I would write a book, or I wanted to write a book. I felt like I had to write a book. And so for the next several years, you know, I went through the complaint process and then the lawsuit. And I knew I needed to wait until all of that finished because that would be part of whatever I needed to write. So when all of that was done in 2004 is when I actually went to Europe, to Budapest, which is where my father's from. And that's when I started to really put it together. And I used that five-page complaint letter as the structure, the first structure for the book, because it was a completely objective account of what he'd done, you know, nothing emotional, nothing like, oh, it made me feel this way. Just he did this, he did this, he did this. And it was enough. It was five pages of transgressions. And so for the next couple of years, I just built on it. I just, you know, went through journals, as I said to you, and I also had my full, from the college complaint and the lawsuit, I had records. So I had all my medical files from the doctor, 1,200 pages. The outcome of this complaint process against the doctor resulted in him writing a 500-page rejoinder. I had a copy of that, which was mostly bullshit, but of course it gave me a view into his into his mind. And so, you know, I just spent the next few years building, and it wasn't even like knowing how to write a book. It was just, okay, I needed to tell the story. But as I wrote the therapy story, I discovered slowly that I needed to go further back into my life to understand what brought me to the therapy, why I stayed, why I didn't leave. I mean, aside from the medications and the nature of the therapy being so imprisoning, I knew that I had a history that would help me understand. So, you know, I started writing more about, you know, my childhood, child sexual abuse, very young age, and how that impacted my feelings of my sexuality. Obviously didn't create my homosexuality, but impacted my feelings, my body sensations, developed great shame. And so this all became part of the story. And then as that developed, I needed to understand my parents. You know, when you start to look backward, you just keep going as far as you want to go. And my parents had very specific events in their lives that I felt were relevant to my story in terms of my mom was 3 years in a concentration camp in Europe. My dad was an orphan in Hungary. And I knew that their history had really impacted me in my childhood in terms of silence, creating silence around trauma and shame of one's history. And these were themes that had spread into my life and certainly throughout the therapy. So I started writing about their histories in my book, you know, relevant things from their life mm-hmm. and how it impacted me mostly in my childhood. And so this just blossomed, you know, it just continued as I wrote. I think that's, you know, that's the answer, I think, yeah.
Well, I mean, going to Europe was a particular part of the book that was intriguing to me, and mostly because it seemed every place you went, there was a catharsis there for you. People showed up that were relatives that you didn't even know existed, or if you did know they existed, of course, nobody had seen them in years or at all, ever. And you found this family that heretofore had been phantom. And now you have all these relatives in Europe. And they're welcoming you into their family, which was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. And I'm sure that went a long way of putting you back, giving you thoughts of going back to your immediate family. I don't know. I mean, I don't even talk to my brother, so I couldn't tell you. But, you know, but I'm stumbling here, but I know you kind of know what I mean, I think. I hope.
Of course, sure. Yes, absolutely. I mean, part of my journey to Europe was at that point related to my father and who, as I say, had been raised an orphan, and he had lost his family and lost contact with other people from Europe after he fled Hungary before the revolution, actually. But after he'd left Europe, he'd lost contact. And so it was really important for me to go back to Europe. Ironically, as part of my writing of the book, you know, because of this journey I explained, I needed to understand my history, my father's history. And so I went to Europe and found some of these relatives and brought that reconnection back to Canada where I live. And it impacted my relationship with my father greatly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a specific passage in the book that when you find his mother's grave and then your half-sister or his half-sister's grave, which was right, they were almost right next to one another, that had to have been huge for you. That was
one thing
that your dad asked you to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It had to have been giant. It had to have been ginormous.
Oh, It was. I mean, my father asked me to try to find his mother's grave. And at the time, it felt like, I hate to use the word burden because I wanted to do anything I could for my father. But, you know, I don't speak Hungarian. And it's not like, I mean, this is not an easy language.
Oh, I'm sure.
So I went to Hungary without the language and trying to find a graveyard and then trying to find a gravestone in that graveyard. I mean, it was, you know, in retrospect, it really called to mind the question of spirituality and the nature, and I'm hesitant to use the word, but the nature of miracles. I mean, what happened through the course of just the writing of the book and the reconnection with my family and going to Europe was felt like some sort of divine intervention. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. So many things came together.
You know,
seemed,
Peter, what I what I felt, especially through the Europe visit, and then home with your folks winning the laptop and your dad going like crazy and Googling and everything. I felt like this, like there had been this search for love throughout this book, and along with so many other themes, obviously. But it's what happens with you and your folks as you prepare to go to Europe, and then when you come back, all of the passages about your time with them, and especially with your dad, who'd been so unwilling to share, you know, anything to speak of, when you wanted so much to know about his history, and he just wouldn't share. And I think his generation, especially if they were involved at all in World War II or around that time, they didn't share. It was something many of us wish our parents would share more about that period in their lives, but for whatever reason, they're quiet about it. And I thought it was so wonderful that I felt like we were having this great romp towards the end of the book. Like, you talk about divine intervention, and I just felt it was time. You'd paid the due, and you were reaping the reward.
Well, it was like,
and
well, thank you.
It was like all this time you thought it was so hard to connect with your dad, and all it took was Hewlett Packard and a laptop.
And it shipped hungry.
Yeah, and Google. I mean, you know.
And he was writing a book.
And he was writing, which was amazing.
Yeah, I was so glad that I read the entire book. If at any point I had thought of putting it down or not pushing through some of the hard things to read, the reward is in experiencing the entire, it's your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reward for all of us, is to get to experience your whole life.
Right. Hey, Bobby, you want to ask the question?
Oh, here we go.
Oh, yes, of course. This is the Writer's Block show, so we like to ask this of all of our guests. Do you believe in Writer's Block? Do you experience it? And if so, share a little bit about what you do about it.
Oh, simple question.
No, not so much.
Jim didn't tell you about the pop quiz at the end, did he?
I told him there was going to be a quiz.
Yeah. You know, I guess to try to be brief, I would say absolutely. I believe in this thing called writer's block, but I think different people can call it something different.
Sure.
I don't think, for me personally, it's about writing. I don't think I'm blocked reading. I think I'm blocked, period. I think I'm not, for instance, I'm a really verbal person, and if I'm just not expressing myself, you know, emotionally with friends and speaking the truth, then it translates in my writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't find myself.
I like that.
What do I do about it? Well, I guess the only thing to do is to push through it, to not give up. I mean, if there's one theme that I could say has carried through this whole journey, it's you know, not giving up. And I thought about giving up so often, but then there's something, some spark down below that just would keep rising to push on. You know, I love sleeping, so I'll just go to bed, I'll sleep, tomorrow morning I'll feel better. And usually I do. Not to undermine it, but you know, it's like you just have to push through those blocks, I think. I mean, there's different tricks, I guess you could call them, you know, different writing in journals and things like this. I usually try to write what most scares me, because usually that's the thing that's preventing me, I think. Mm-hmm. And even if it's in my journal, to write something that I'm scared to look at,
well,
that'll help.
I think that happens to everybody who writes. I mean, personally, I call it writer's pause.
Yes.
Richard, do you have a a whole different take on it.
Well, because I'm coming from 20 years of working for newspapers, you know, if you wanted a job, you wanted to get paid, you didn't get writer's block.
That's true.
So, I mean, when I find I'm struggling with something, what I will do is I will just put it aside and take a day or two and just don't even think about it. Go do something else for a while and then come back. And usually that reset is what helps me. So, it's kind of a pause, I mean, a combination of a pause and a break or a block or something like that.
There you go. Well, Peter, we're going to have to say goodbye to you. We're going to be running out of time shortly. Mm-hmm. Can you tell everybody about the website and email addresses and all that good stuff?
Thank you. So the website is just the name of the book, which is www.inheritanceofshame.com. And everything you need is on the website. I mean, the description of the book, some reviews. There's a contact page. You can reach me. I have a blog. So there's a blog on the website. And all media that I've had around the book. So interviews, reviews, some radio interviews.
Right.
I mean, everything's there.
It's a great website, incidentally.
It is.
It's very informative. And, well, again, we applaud you, and congratulations on your book. It's a terrific read. And if anybody out there is remotely interested in the trials and tribulations of, what did you call it? Conversion therapy. We all know it doesn't work. Here's a man that can tell you firsthand. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. And we hope you do well. And on your second book, hey, give us a holler. We'll have you back.
It's been an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great evening.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. And here we have Mr. Henry Park.
Here's Henry.
Oops.
Hello, how are you?
We're doing good. Henry, how are you doing?
I'm doing just peachy, thank you.
Oh, good. Let me see.
And that was a fascinating discussion. That sounds like a really interesting book.
Oh, I think I have Bobby Jean on hold now.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Hello, Bobby Jean, wherever you are.
You know what? I keep doing this, and I don't know why I keep doing it. I keep hitting resume call, and I can never get the call to resume. And then Ronan has to run in here and look at me like I'm an idiot, which I am.
And
anyway, how the hell are you, Henry?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
There's some interesting stuff coming up. Some good screenings and other events coming soon that I wanted to tip you about.
Just a second. Bobby Jean, call us back. There you go. That'll do it. That'll work. All right, call us back. Okay.
All right. Well, this Saturday at the Autry, as part of their What is a Western series, they'll be screening what I consider the Citizen Kane of Westerns, John Ford's Stagecoach.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Oh, and it's going to be introduced by, I'll probably say it wrong, Jared Moshe, who directed the recent
Ballad
of Lefty Brown.
Oh, I love that. I just saw that. That's great.
It's on the top of my list to see. Again, I'm waiting for a screener to come in. He's also going to introduce Sergeant Rutledge when they show that in February.
Oh, another one of my favorites. Man, you're hitting them right and left tonight.
You said it. And a week from this Saturday, the Autry will present the first movie in their silent treatment series, 1923's The Covered Wagon, with a live piano accompaniment.
Uh-huh.
And speaking of live events, are you familiar with Helen Hunt Jackson's book, Ramona?
Oh, you know what? Years and years ago.
Right.
I don't remember much about it.
Well, Helen Hunt Jackson was a poet and a social reformer and the first woman commissioner of Indian Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to expose the mistreatment of American Indians, and in 1881 she wrote a serious treatise called A Century of Dishonor about it, and nobody read it.
Oh, that's nice.
No, it died a death.
Nah.
So 3 years later, she dealt with all the same issues in a romantic novel called Ramona,
mm-hmm.
and to this day it has never been out of print.
Wow.
And it really did a fine job of exposing the unfair treatment of Indians and Mexican Americans. It's been filmed almost a dozen times. My favorite is the 1936 one with Loretta Young and Don Ameche. Inspiration for this story came from Jackson's 1882 two-hour visit between trains to Rancho Camulas, or however one says it, near Piru out in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
that Rancho still stands. It's virtually unchanged. And on Sunday, February 11th, they'll be reenacting her inspirational visit, commemorating that event with costume performers, including cast members from the Hemet Ramona Outdoor Pageant, which they've been doing every year since 1923.
Oh, I remember that.
Right. It's a wonderful place to visit and time travel, and only costs $5. It's free if you're under 12. Are you under 12? I've been meaning to ask.
Oh, yeah, Henry, I'm under 12.
I think I can fake it. I think I can do it.
Okay.
Hey, well, pal, none of us are under 12 in this room.
I'll have to dye the gray
Very
hair.
Very few of us are under 50. None of us are under 50.
Do I hear 60?
Oh, I'll go for 60.
I'm not there yet. Oh, quit pushing me.
Well, now, I'm also going to be catching up on some stories I've been meaning to do. I'll be covering the wonderful American Indian Art show from the recent show at the Autry. I'll finally be reviewing Two Gun Heart, Jeff MacArthur's fascinating
book
about
you.
The Western lawman who was secretly Al Capone's brother.
Great book.
Yes, terrific. Oh, and I'll be looking at some brand new video releases of some pretty old westerns from Alpha Video, starring in the leads two actors who spent almost all of their time playing bit players or villains.
Oh, very cool.
One is Tom Tyler, who played Luke Plummer, the man who killed John Wayne's brother in Stagecoach.
Right.
And had lots of small roles in John Ford and Howard Hawks westerns. He played the mummy when Karloff got tired of it.
I've seen that movie.
Yeah.
Do you remember Kermit Maynard?
No.
He was the kid brother of the big star, Ken Maynard.
Ken Maynard. Okay. No, I still don't remember him.
Well, Kermit, by the mid-50s through the 60s, he was mostly playing uncredited bartenders and townsmen. But when he got the chance to really act, he was a very good actor and very likable. For my money, he was a much better actor than Ken, although no one could do what with a horse but Ken could do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
He plays a Mountie in this one. Anyhow, you can read all about this and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Thanks, Henry. Oh, incidentally, a little bit of news for you. I co-hosted on a show here yesterday with Sam in the morning, and the guests were some filmmakers from Australia, and they filmed a what did I tell you that it was a novel by, or a story by Jack London.
Yeah, there you go.
Called Lost Face. It's about the Russian American fur traders and the Native American. This is the Inuits and down into Yukon and into Canada. It's a short. It's 14 minutes long. They are in contention for the Academy Award.
Outstanding. That sounds fascinating.
And it is a, well, it's not exactly a Western. It's an old, it's a pre-Western, but still, I was impressed.
Well, yeah, I am too. Well, I go by John Ford's rule, which he didn't talk usually about Westerns. He said, I do outdoor pictures.
Oh, there you go. I like it.
And
I like
it. It definitely counts as that.
I like it. And now they want to make a Mountain Man movie, and of course they've got a copy of Jonah Blue, so there you have it. Which also you do as well, Henry. Henry, you have one too.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
We all do. Thank you, Henry, so much for joining us. I got to rush you off. Okay.
All right. Happy trails.
Okay, talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You know what was good about this week's show?
What?
It was quiet here.
It was, yes. We didn't have anybody next door. That was
the
really
last
nice.
2 weeks, it's been a little noisy in the background.
It
this
has
week,
been.
It has been pleasantly quiet.
It has been. We're running a little over on time, so I just want to get this out next week. We have Mark Reynolds with us, and he's got a 553-page book that he is actually, this is his second shot. He canceled his first time. This is his second shot on the writer's block, and he's going to go through it this time. So I'll be in the studio next week with Russ Avison.
I will be elsewhere.
And you will be elsewhere, as Bobby Jean will be elsewhere, and it'll be Russ and I, and of course, All Dogs Rule. And for Richard and Bobby Jean, sorry we hung up on you, Bobby Jean, but better luck, you know, the next time you're on. I hope I can do better. I really do. I hate to do that to you. Next Thursday, and we will be back, same bat time, same bat station, and that's it. We're out of here.
Or a child's uneven scrawl, up a narrow flight of stairs in a narrow little room,
as I lie upon my bed in the early evening gloom.